Good evening. I'm Kilowatt 2 Romeo India Whiskey, and my name is Dick. Among other people you'll hear tonight, you'll be hearing K2KEY. His name is Mel. And Mel and Dick, I try to act as the host and net controls for the technical net. This is TechNet number 1357 of the series of TechNets that began 28 and a half years ago, way back in 1982. Main purpose of the TechNet is education. We try to educate each other. We try to help each other understand all these complicated concepts that are involved with ham radio and wireless electronics in general. I give us a little bit of an explanation at the beginning of the TechNet. I know you guys are tired of hearing it by now, but there are some new people signing in all the time. According to that website, amateurradio.tangovictor, run by a very hardworking guy named Mike Perry, KC2NJI, 198,000 people have visited that website, and some of their motivation for going there is to listen to the past 6 years of TechNet. Something like 1,500 hours worth of TechNets are there recorded. You can play them back, and a good percentage of them are documented as to what subject is being discussed during each 10 minutes of those particular TechNets. There's an awful lot of brain power in the New York City, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut area. We try to tap into that by way of this TechNet. Lucky for us, this particular repeater has moderately good coverage of those three states, or at least those three regions. A person signing into the TechNet, let me drop, gives me and Mel your call letters, your name, try to remember the name, because I'm so darn forgetful, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Our schedule is such that we try to, during the first hour, at least give a brief explanation for each of the questions we're given. In other words, in theory, a person signing in the beginning during the first hour doesn't have to wait more than an hour to get at least a partial answer. At the end of the hour, we go to the mailbag for people who have sent in requests for information, particularly the people who are in the process of getting their ham radio license. A significant number of people, obvious by the emails Mel and I get each year. Some people find us by word of mouth or by way of a scanner and say, gee, these people are having a lot of fun with ham radio. I think I'm going to join them. I'm going to go get my license. So those people have all kinds of questions, helping them get the license, and they go to the top of our priority list, and we try to answer those starting at 9 o'clock. After that, if something interesting has happened in space, and you know something darn interesting has happened this week, the last launch of the shuttle, Paul, our space expert, WS2N, tells us what's going on with Master. After that, let me drop. The tail end of the evening is where we dig into the deeper stuff. And that doesn't please everybody. We know that. That's where the highly curious people who want to know at the molecular level, at the atomic level, what are these electrons and protons really doing? What is this electronics doing? How do these radio waves really propagate? And another conversation was held during the week in which some further findings along those lines have happened. You may think you understand coaxial cable. We've suddenly discovered some funny things are happening inside of coaxial cable. You'll be hearing that beyond, let's say, 9:30 or 10 o'clock or so. We know that that material, the deeper material, doesn't please everybody, but know ahead of time it's going to happen. And if it's something you don't want to listen to, then there are 900 channels on your 2-meter synthesized radio. You can tune to one of the other channels to come to the conclusion that you do not want to hear that. It's not a valid thing. The fact that some people have curious and want to dig into that, let them do it. But the fact that you don't like it and you want to disrupt it, that's kind of silly. It shows, it's a demonstration of the fact that you're unhappy with your life. Someone else is showing curiosity and finding pleasure out of digging in this material. And if that person doing the disruption thinks he's going to get pleasure by disrupting other people, then that's a pointless thing to do. He'll soon discover that it doesn't really work and doesn't make him happy. So from time to time, we do hear disruption. It's a sign of the times. It's happening in all the metro areas of the world where there's a 2-meter repeater, so to speak. Let me drop. there are disruptors or jammers almost everywhere. So, in other words, there's a small percentage of the population who thinks they're going to get pleasure out of doing that because they think they can remain anonymous for a period of time. We ignore them, and we just keep going right on. We don't give them recognition, which would only give them incentive to keep doing it. And to get mad at them is silly. Yeah, because you're trying to have a conversation and somebody's slowing down that conversation, it's easy to get mad. But a person's not much bigger than the thing that makes him angry. The fact that somebody is having a tough time with his life, and you should be feeling sorry for him, as opposed to mad at him, is a possible rational way of responding to the whole thing. So don't let that trouble you. Occasionally it happens. So we're going to take check-ins at this time. Please check in if you do have a question or a comment. You need not check in to say you're listening. After 28 and a half years, we believe somebody is listening. This TechNet has lasted 1,356 up till now. This is the 57th. Alrighty, give me your call letters and name, and that word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. K2RIW listening.
KC2MDP, Steve, and yes.
I never heard of that guy, Steve. Okay, Steve, he's number one. And who's next?
Good evening, Paul. KCY.
Okay, we heard Joe, number two. We heard Mel, number three. We'll assume Mel's got a question or a comment. That was a joke. And Mel, as you know, is one of our net control people. After we finish taking these check-ins, at the suggestion of Joe, I'm going to particularly allow some extra time so that people who would like to sign in from the outer areas by way of IRLP, which takes a longer reset time, we'll be giving you that opportunity momentarily for the IRL people to sign in. But for the local people, anyone else to check in? We've got Steve and Joe so far. Give me your call letters and name and the word yes if you do have a question or a comment. K2RIW listening.
WS2N, Paul, with yes, because of the space report. We have a space report. Good evening, Dave.
Yeah, did anything exciting happen this week, Paul? That's a joke. because of the very last launch of the shuttle, and I was extremely happy to see that it launched on the very first day as opposed to the second day. As you know, they load up those tanks with cryogenic fluids, and if they can't launch due to weather or whatever during the first day, then they launch on the second day. And it's my belief that the danger involved goes up significantly on the second day because you've got these cryogenic fluids sitting there for a longer period of time and potentially making a collection of frozen air and ice in that foam that can break off and do damage to the leading edge of a wing. So even though there was bad weather predictions, they were able to launch the first day. I was very glad to see that. Alrighty, one last call. Anyone else locally to give us their name and call letters because they do have a question or a comment? And the word yes, please do that right now. Okay, now we're going to give the longer delay. If anyone in the outer areas, by way of IRLP or Echolink or any of the other longer reset time techniques would like to check in, give me your call letters and name and the word yes right now. And maybe at this time there's not. And a little bit later I'll give a large pause one more time for an ILP person. Okay, Steve, I'm trying to look back at my list here. Yeah, let's see where Steve last week. What in the world are my notes on that one? I know you signed in last week, and I'm trying to figure out what we talked about last week. And from my notes, I can't figure it out. I'm lucky I can even remember your name, Steve. KC2MDP, go right ahead. K2RIW.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah, sometimes I forget which side of bed to get out of. Last week we were talking about the antenna tuner, the HF antenna tuner, if we could use it on VHF. Today my question is concerning power dividers. You know, I'm looking for a power divider, and I'm looking on eBay, you know, and I found a few, and basically they're from like 500 megahertz to like 2 gig range. I was curious how frequency sensitive these things are. Could I use one of these things down on UHF? And does it matter? I am looking for a three-port one. Do I have to specifically get a three-port power divider for my application, or can I use a, let's say, a four- or a five-port? Back to you, Dick.
Okay, power dividers. And there are a number of things that sound different, but they really are the same. A pure power divider with good frequency response and good balancing, standing wave ratio, could be a so-called Wilkinson hybrid. That's a so-called zero-degree hybrid, Wilkinson hybrid. That's the one that when you see it as a schematic diagram, you have a common input connector, which goes through a pair of 70-ohm cables that are a quarter wavelength long. At the end of the 70-ohm cables are your two output ports, and between the two, internally, there's a 100-ohm resistor between those two output ports. That Wilkinson hybrid, with good design, can be made to cover at least an octave, and if you go beyond that octave, it doesn't explode. It just doesn't give you the same degree of lower standing wave ratio. You get a climbing standing wave ratio as you get out of that area. Believe it or not, a simple T connector makes an extremely good temporary, at least, power divider. A T connector, yes, you've got one input on the common port and two outputs, and your two outputs at 50 ohms come together and make a 25 ohm load to the input connector. That's a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. And if you didn't do anything else to re-impedance match, the 2-to-1 standing wave ratio gives you half a dB of loss. One year I won a antenna gain contest competition by putting a pair of Yagis together. I didn't have time to find a power divider because it was a brand new design. That was the so-called insulated Yagi, the 19 element, RIW-19. And when I put a pair of them together, I did it with a T connector and with a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. It took a half a dB detriment, but still there was enough gain there to either take first or second place. I don't remember. That was way back in the dark.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
As I was starting to say, that was way back in the dark ages of the late 70s. 1978, 79 is when that occurred. So in a pinch, a simple T connector can do very nicely. Type N, BNC, or whatever, UHF T connector is not bad. The next level of 2-to-1 power dividers are a quadrature hybrid, a 3 dB coupler or quadrature hybrid, two different names for the exact same object. They do a beautiful job of giving you a 2-to-1 power divide. And however, you can tell by the name that the two outputs are a quarter wavelength apart. So if you're dividing the signal in order to go to two separate antennas, you might want to make one of the cables a quarter wavelength longer to recompensate so the two signals come out in phase. If you did have in your hand a 3-to-1, 4-to-1, or 5-to-1 power divider, with proper design, that kind of a device only gives the right input impedance and output impedance if it has the exact same number of loads. If it's a 3-to-1 power divider, it does when I have three loads. Common sense would lead you to believe that you could connect, if it was a 4-to-1 power divider and you connected three of the outputs that you're using and left the fourth port unterminated, you'd think that that would be okay. Well, it really is dividing the power four ways. It's sending power to that open-circuited port, and that open-circuited port is going to have a certain line length going to it. It hits an open circuit. The signal reflects back, and it comes back somewhat out of phase, and it's going to give you some grief. So it really is dividing the power, and even though you're not using it, it's going to give you some grief if you don't use it, if you know what I mean. So if you want a 3-to-1 power divider, in a pinch you could use a 4-to-1, and either do or don't terminate the fourth port, but you're wasting 25% of your power approximately by doing that. I'm trying to think of some of the other things you ought to know. The usual way that guys build a 3-to-1, 4-to-1, 5-to-1, 6-to-1, because they're loading up that number of antennas on the mast. Let me drop.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The usual way a guy does that is to realize that when he puts three loads together, in other words, he takes a square piece of tubing, like an inch square hollow tubing, rectangular tubing, or a square tubing, aluminum tubing. He puts three connectors at one end and one connector at the other end, makes it a quarter wavelength long, and uses the right impedance of cable in between the two. Three loads at one end in parallel are going to bring you down to something like 16 and two-thirds ohms, I think it is. And then you make a quarter-wave matching transformer between 16 ohms and 50. I don't know the exact number, but maybe it's 35-ohm coax. So you make a quarter wavelength of 35-ohm coax in there by choosing the right diameter of brass tubing to go from one end to the other end. And that becomes a beautiful, uncompensated, as they say. In other words, it doesn't have any isolation between the output ports, but it does a beautiful job of dividing the power 3-to-1 and giving a proper impedance match everywhere, the so-called quarter-wave matching transformer. With that technique, that's the usual way guys will feed two or more antennas, that they want them all to be in phase. That technique could be carried at least to 8-to-1 power divide. When you do an 8-to-1, you really make a piece of square tubing half wavelength long. Let me drop. And you make it a 4-to-1 power divider to the right and a 4-to-1 power divider to the left with the main input common connector in the center. That's the usual way it's done. And on the four sides on the right, you mount the four type N connectors. You do the same thing on the left. And so it's really a pair of 4-to-1 power dividers in parallel as far as the main input connector is concerned. Properly built, that thing is essentially lossless, gives good impedance match, gives good balancing, as long as all the output loads have approximately the same impedance. So there's lots of ways of doing power dividing. The quarter wave matching technique is, among amateurs with home brewing techniques, probably the most popular. Guarantee you're going to have some more questions on this one, Steve, as time goes on. You're going to do a little bit more research. You now know some of the buzzwords to search with Google. And after you start your construction or your purchasing, whichever you decide to do, please come back and let us know how it goes. KC2MDP, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, very good. Thank you for the wealth of information. Yeah, I was looking in the antenna book, and I was, looking under the Wilkinson divider and everything else, and it looked fairly straightforward to build, and, I was going to have a couple of questions on that for you tonight, but I figured just for the heck of it, let me look on eBay and see what they got, and sure enough, they got a whole bunch of them, and to tell you the truth, the price is right. I mean, the average price of these things is, $10-$12 you can pick them up for. So I said to myself, it's not even worth the connector and the coax to actually build one. But yes, I will have some future questions for you because it's a learning process, and I appreciate all the info, Dick. So thanks again, and back to you.
Oh, wait, check in, Dick, and do we owe you a question?
Very fine, Rich, you're on the list. I should have told you that the Wilkinson technique can be carried out to not only 2-to-1 power divider. I've seen a Wilkinson-like device for 3-to-1 and 4-to-1 power divide. If you get a hold of a book called Strip Line Techniques by Hall and Howe, H-O-W-E, and Hall and Howe's book I think is now in its second edition, beautiful book. If you wanted to homebrew power dividers with Strip Line Techniques by Hall and Howe, has all the design curves and physical layouts and whatever. With a little bit of engineering knowledge, lots and lots of very good information are in that particular book. And it takes a prominent location on my particular bookshelf, technical bookshelf. I'm trying to think, there was something else I wanted to tell you. That's the multiple beyond two Wilkinson. The Wilkinson anisotropy probe. The microwave Wilkinson anisotropy probe is one of those things that was put into space to measure all the background noise to do a very precise radio astronomy measurement. WMAP, I think it's called. You Google those words with NASA, and you'll see some beautiful information. Alrighty, the next person on the list was Joseph, WA2RYY. And how are things going in your neighborhood, Joe? K2RYW in the TechNet.
How you doing? WHYY. My question tonight has to do with lighting. I recently bought some LED bulbs in place of fluorescent bulbs, and I have a rating on them. I want to understand what this rating is, because it's used on the fluorescent lamps as well as the LED lamps. And that is a number followed by the designation K. In other words, the LED light I bought was called Soft White. You know, it had a rating of 60 watts, and it was called Soft White at 2700K. I currently have compact fluorescent lights in the house in some light, in some rooms, especially the kitchen, which I'm in now, and those are called Daylight, and they have a rating of 6500K. That's initially what I'm trying to understand, is that rating of that bulb, because the LED bulb I bought, which had a rating of 60 watts, by eye, it visually seemed to look like a 40-watt incandescent bulb. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, that word K stands for Kelvin. If you Google the word black body radiation, Rayleigh jeans, curve, trying to think of some of the other words that are used, if you had something that really is what they call spectrally black, in other words, really good black paint, so to speak, put on a piece of steel, and you put the piece of steel in an oven, or you heat it up with a blowtorch, as it gets hotter and hotter, at first it glows very dull red, then a brighter red, then orange, and then yellow, and eventually white, and so on. So the so-called Rayleigh jeans curve, it's also got another name, the Wien's displacement curve. As you take any particular object that is capable of emitting at those particular optical wavelengths, and you heat it to a particular temperature, then assuming that the material really doesn't have any built-in absorption lines because of its chemistry, it really is emitting like a blackbody, a broadband device, then the temperature in degrees Kelvin and what the light looks like has a known nearly one-to-one relationship. When you're looking at normal sunlight in your backyard, I don't know the exact number, but I think it's something in the vicinity of 5,500 degrees Kelvin. 5,500 degrees Kelvin is the approximate surface temperature of the sun. Let me drop. And that particular temperature gives you a kind of white light that you and I recognize as full daylight. An incandescent bulb, with rare exception, incandescent bulbs can't go anywhere near that high in temperature. In theory, you could put higher voltage, you could take a 120-volt light bulb and put 150 volts into it, and for a very short period of time, you could bring that filament up to 5,500 degrees Kelvin, and it would look like sunlight. But for a whole bunch of reasons, that light bulb will probably last you a half an hour, as opposed to some numbers of hundreds or a thousand hours, if you know what I mean. So there's a strong relationship between life of an incandescent bulb and what temperature you run the filament at. The so-called photo floodlights that are used in the old days for portrait photography, I think they were rated at something like 3,500, 3,700 degrees Kelvin. They didn't last long, but they were super bright. And an ordinary incandescent light bulb can be numbers like 2,700. So the first complaint that people had when they were picking up compact fluorescent light bulbs, these new, more efficient light bulbs, is that they looked too bluish. It was very harsh. And so the equivalent Kelvin temperature of the spectrum of light that comes out of a compact fluorescent tube is something like 6,500 degrees Kelvin. It's a very bluish light. 5,500 is sunlight, 55 is starting to get blue. I should have told you that as the object gets hotter and hotter, it goes from orange, yellow, white, and it starts becoming blue, and then violet, so to speak. When you get to higher and higher temperatures, the peak of the emission, where the maximum power is coming out, goes to shorter and shorter wavelengths. So a higher temperature object, you could say, is emitting a higher frequency in cycles per second, in hertz per in hertz.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And you got to be careful on that one, because the light that's in the room with you right now, the average frequency is something like 10 to the 15 hertz. It's a really big number. Everyone knows what roughly 600 megahertz is. If you multiply that by a million, you've got approximately the center of the optical wavelength of 550 nanometers. There's a wavelength relationship, a frequency relationship, and the hotter something is, it emits more energy at all frequencies, but the peak of the energy moves to higher and higher frequencies, shorter and shorter wavelengths, as you make the object hotter and hotter. In order to get around that, some of the more modern compact fluorescent light bulbs have two different kinds of phosphor inside. One chunk of phosphor is emitting at roughly 6,500. Another one's emitting at, I don't know the exact number, but it's probably around 4,000 Kelvin. And when you mix the two together, the human eye says, hey, that almost looks like normal sunlight. Let me give you another example of something funny going on. If I take a blue crayon and a yellow crayon, and I allow them to overlap, my eye sees green. My eye sees green. You use the right kind of an optical spectrum analyzer, and you'll find out there's a blue line and a yellow line there. Your eye gets fooled. Your eye has red, green, and blue sensitive objects inside of its cones, and when it looks at a certain ratio between those colors, the eye does a wavelength interpolation, and it thinks it sees green. A real green line and a phony green line made out of a mixture of red and blue and yellow fools the eye, and you think you see green, but it's not. Mr. Land, the Polaroid Land process with his color photography, was also using all kinds of fancy tricks. He wasn't making all of those colors on that color print that you got. He was fooling your eye, if you know what I mean. So by the same token, these compact fluorescent bulbs have a mixture of phosphors inside that are emitting two separate lines, and it fools the eye into thinking that it's pure daylight. But as you can see, Joe, once you know the degrees Kelvin, in theory you know how blue or how reddish or how whitish is the light that you're going to be getting out of that light bulb or that light-emitting diode. W2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
Okay, I guess I got it this time. I'm trying to understand more of what you're talking about. That number in Kelvin, are you actually talking about a rating in actual physical temperature of the device itself, or is it more of a number that's related to what the apparent temperature would be?
Yeah, that's a darn good question, Joe, and there's a mixture of answers on that one. If the object was a pure black body radiator, like a heated up chunk of steel, then what wavelength of light you get out of it as the peak of its emission, and what physical temperature the steel has, there's a one-to-one relationship. When it comes to what's really going on inside of a compact fluorescent bulb, inside of a compact fluorescent bulb, you've got a mercury vapor. The mercury vapor, with high voltage going through it, is creating a plasma arc. The majority of the plasma arc is emitting ultraviolet light, which the eye essentially doesn't see. The ultraviolet light hits the phosphor, and the phosphor reconverts that into visual light. So is the phosphor really at 6,500 degrees Kelvin? Of course not. It would melt itself right through the glass, if you know what I mean. It's emitting, the phosphor has got some fancy chemical characteristics to it that where it emits light as if it was a chunk of steel at 6,500 degrees Kelvin. It really isn't that temperature. Inside of the plasma, in the center of that plasma, gas. In the middle of the gas going down the center of the tube, yeah, it's at some really high temperatures. But the outer portions of that plasma touching the glass are much, much colder. The emission from the center hits the phosphor, and the phosphor re-emits. So it's not physically at that temperature. Same thing when it comes to the light-emitting diode. Is there a portion of the light-emitting diode that's rated at 6,500 Kelvin? Is it really at that temperature? No way in hell. It would melt itself you know that the silicon and the gallium arsenide and whatever else is inside of that light-emitting diode, you go to those particular temperatures and it'll become a pool of molten stuff on your bench, if you know what I mean. So it's emitting light as if it was a chunk of steel, so to speak, at that temperature. But it doesn't necessarily...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
To emit that particular wavelength, if you've got the right kind of chemistry like phosphor, then you don't have to physically be at that temperature. But still, where's the center of the light output? There's a one-to-one relationship between degrees Kelvin and where the peak of the wavelength of light output is. So as you can see, there's a kind of a yes and a no, depending on what is the real emitter doing the work, Joe. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, if I understand this correctly, that would mean they have to have some sort of photoelectric sensor that they're calibrating off some sort of optical standard to be able to make these measurements and mean something, correct?
Yes, now you're getting into the real calorimetry, photometry. I can't even think of the names of the words they use, but yes, there's fancy instrumentation, which really is an optical spectrum analyzer, Joe. Chromaticity. If you Google the word chromaticity diagram, you'll see this lopsided triangular thing where there's kinds of wavelengths and degrees Kelvins around the perimeter, and you see various colors in the center, and depending on how much contrast, so to speak, what's the magnitude of the color content, what's the magnitude of the luminance. There's a luminance and chrominance number, and so with that chromaticity diagram, which really is being measured by the equivalent of an optical spectrum analyzer. An optical spectrum analyzer, just like the radio spectrum analyzer you and I use, scans across those optical frequencies, measures the power output, finds the peak of the beam, or really looks at how much area is under the curve to the right of center and to the left of center, and comes up with some kind of an average number of an object at that number of degrees Kelvin would give approximately that spectral output, if you know what I mean. So it's not quite as simple as you and I would like it to be, because various objects, as you heat them up, are not going to always give you exactly the same curve. Some objects, as you heat them up, will suck out certain particular frequencies. You take, for instance, what does the reflection off of a silvered mirror look like? Let me drop. Since the silvered mirror reflects essentially all optical wavelengths, you and I call it silver. And no matter what light we put into a silvered mirror, we seem to get that exact same light back out. You take a gold shiny surface and you shine light at it, you don't get all the optical frequencies anymore. The shorter wavelengths don't get reflected by the gold. They get either scattered in some funny way or absorbed. And therefore, what's left over is red shifted in a particular way, and you and I call it gold. The color that you and I see of gold is really a reflective object that doesn't reflect all wavelengths equally. I wonder if that helps a little bit. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Starting to make some sense. So you're saying like a bulb that had a rating of 2700K would be essentially the same effect of you heating a piece of steel to a certain temperature to 2700K. Okay, maybe so I can understand this further and relate it and put it in direct relationship. What is the relationship between Kelvin and degrees?
Tom, good question. 0 degrees Kelvin, here we go, 0 degrees centigrade. 0 degrees centigrade is a temperature scale that was set up knowing that at normal temperature and pressure, normal atmospheric temperature and pressure, water will freeze on the centigrade scale at 0 degrees and boil at 100 degrees. Happens to equal the same thing as 32 Fahrenheit and 212 Fahrenheit for freezing and boiling. Absolute zero is minus 273.15 degrees centigrade. If I go 273.15 degrees centigrade negative. I'm at absolute zero. Temperature is the measure of the average kinetic energy of the molecules you're measuring. So if by some means those molecules that are bouncing all around, I got gas in a container, those individual gas molecules are bouncing all over in that container. As they start cooling off the air that's in that container, those air molecules move slower and slower. Your thermometer that's in there measures lower and lower temperature. That really means that the molecules of air moving slower, hitting the bulb on your thermometer, transfer less heat into your thermometer. Your thermometer now has a fluid that contracts when it gets cold, and therefore you see the red scale go down, if you know what I mean. So if I slow down those air molecules more and more and I bring them to a complete stop, that happens to happen at what you and I call absolute zero. It's minus 273.15 or 17, I think it is, degrees centigrade. And now there's a third or fourth temperature scale, which they call the Kelvin scale. Kelvin scale starts off at what you and I call absolute zero, and that's absolute zero in the Kelvin scale.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Therefore, you could say water boils at 273 degrees Kelvin. 273 degrees above absolute zero, 0 degrees centigrade, same point on the, if I got a thermometer with a whole bunch of scales on it, the exact same temperature that you and I call 0 degrees centigrade, and I move over a little bit to the right on that exact same scale, the exact same temperature, I'll see 32 degrees Fahrenheit. 32 degrees Fahrenheit, 0 degrees centigrade, and plus 273 degrees Kelvin. Those are all the exact same temperature, just different temperature scales. The degree Kelvin scale is an extremely handy scale if you're a radio astronomer, if you're an optical technician, if you want to measure the noise figure of a low noise preamplifier. The degree Kelvin scale gives you a lot of more simplified mathematics compared to centigrade or Fahrenheit scale. So maybe that helps a little bit, Joe. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
It's starting to make more sense. Is the Kelvin scale related more to Fahrenheit, that scale, in its linearity, or is it related more to a centigrade scale? Because 0 degrees centigrade is 32 degrees, 100 degrees centigrade is 212. It's got a ratio right there of 180 parts in Fahrenheit, which means 100 parts in centigrade. So what scale would you more relate that to, the Kelvin scale?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question, Joe. The way I worded it, you could easily get the impression you just got, and I led you astray. The centigrade scale and the Kelvin scale are the identical scale. They are just shifted. So centigrade and Kelvin are tightly related to each other. 1 degree change Kelvin and 1 degree change centigrade is the exact same amount of change in temperature. So the Kelvin scale is the centigrade scale, just shifted 273.15 degrees. Let's round it off, 273 degrees. If I take the centigrade scale and just recalibrate all the numbers, I simply add 273 to every one of the centigrade numbers, I've now got Kelvin numbers. So Kelvin is with reference to absolute zero. 0 degrees Kelvin is really absolute zero in temperature. You cannot go negative on the Kelvin scale. Okay? Lots of people love the Fahrenheit scale. And they say, gee, why can't I have an absolute zero in Fahrenheit? It's called the Rankine scale. In the Fahrenheit world, absolute zero is something like minus 280. I don't know the exact number. Something like minus 280 degrees Fahrenheit. So if you shift the Fahrenheit scale by that offset number, you now get the Rankine scale. So absolute temperature in the Fahrenheit-like scale is called Rankine. Absolute zero in the centigrade scale is called Kelvin. Kelvin is the most popular one worldwide among serious scientists that are measuring the temperature out of the star, the spectral irradiance out of an emitting device, or how good is the low noise preamplifier. A real good preamplifier with a 1 dB noise figure happens to have 73 degrees Kelvin of equivalent temperature. A 50 ohm resistor, let me drop. A 50 ohm resistor at 73 degrees Kelvin, which is approximately the temperature of boiling liquid nitrogen. If I got liquid nitrogen at room temperature and room pressure, at room pressure, and I got it boiling away in a beaker, and I put my Kelvin thermometer in there, I'll measure something like 73 degrees Kelvin. If I take my 50 ohm resistor at room temperature, my 50 ohm resistor puts out a known amount of noise. There's random agitation going on with those carbon molecules that are inside of my 50 ohm resistor, my termination, and if it turns out that it generates an amount of radio noise at essentially all frequencies of minus 114 dBm per megacycle. A 50 ohm resistor at room temperature does that. If I now take my 50 ohm resistor and put it in this bath of liquid nitrogen, where I bring it from room temperature down to 73 degrees Kelvin, it now emits a much smaller amount of noise. And by the way, the nice thing about the absolute temperature scale is that everything stays as a ratio. You half the degrees Kelvin of any physical object that's making noise or making light output or whatever. You half the degrees Kelvin, you half the noise power output. So now I know exactly how much noise power my 50 ohm termination is going to give me, as long as you tell me the physical temperature that you're holding it at. And now I can use that to calibrate my low noise preamplifier. If my low noise preamplifier has a 1 decibel noise figure, that means the random noise made at the front end of that preamplifier is identical to a resistor that is at 73 degrees Kelvin. There's an exact relationship between degrees Kelvin and what you and I call noise figure. So maybe that helps a little bit. I know there's a lot more to it, and I know it's got to be a little bit confusing. You're going to have to hear this.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You're going to have to hear all of this jazz about cryogenic electronics. You're going to have to hear all of this a few times before it makes sense. But I'm glad you're asking the questions, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW.
Quiz of mine wants to know.
Okay. Have we almost answered your questions for the day? Over to you, Joe, for a final.
When you gave me the relationship between Kelvin and centigrade, that makes it much more understandable as far as relating it to apparent light, as far as visual light, what that means, comparing it to, say, heating up a portion of steel or something like that, okay? It's starting to make more sense now. Okay, I got another question, but I'm going to ask you much later in the set that has to do completely with something else and not DTV.
Yeah, this relationship of what spectral emission you get. In other words, is that chunk of steel a dull red, a bright red, an orange, a yellow, a white, a blue? You're heating up a chunk of steel with your blowtorch or with your arc welder, and you know that you need a particular temperature in order to do the annealing process, the stress hardening process, or whatever. There's got to be specific temperatures at which you want to bring a piece of steel. You could either go out there and buy some very expensive instrumentation to measure the exact temperature of this glowing white hot chunk of steel, or with experience, a person says, yeah, I recognize that color. It's a dull red. That's the temperature where this particular kind of welding works the best. And the guy can tell with his eye, within a very small range, what is the temperature of his steel, and therefore, is he getting the correct process? He may be mixing the steel because he's trying to make a particular alloy. He may be producing a particular kind of a weld. He's doing a certain kind of a thermal stress hardening, and so on. And by looking at the color, he knows the temperature of the steel. It's so simple, so to speak, and yet you get down to what's going on at the molecular level, it's a little bit more complicated. What else is new? Okay, the second person who signed in with, first one was Steve, second was Joe, third one is going to be, it was Paul, but Paul's got us a space report, not necessarily a question. Rich, N2EO. Mr. Tashner, how are things in your neighborhood? I hear tell that you're getting ready for a visit. W2 N2EO, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Dick. Getting a visit next Monday in 2EO. Dick, I have a computer question. I know this this TechNet doesn't lean very heavily toward computers, but possibly somebody might know. I have it's about a 10-year-old laptop that belongs to an individual, and this person has another computer right now, another laptop, but this one here has, they may have been lost, about 100 photographs on the computer that I'm trying to recover. It keeps coming up hard drive failure. I got it to boot. I ran check disk on it. And I'm now running defrag on it. And I got it coming up, but it's running very, very, very slow. Any thoughts on how to recover if they're still there? It says there's a 39% loss of data. Let me let it reset. Okay, and it's only a 32 gigabyte drive. By today's standards, that's small. And it says, what does it say? 32 gigs, it says 39% data loss. It says that there's a bad sector on the hard drive. So I'm wondering if what I might do to try and recover this stuff. The photographs, there's about 100 or more photographs on there that I want to recover for somebody. Back to that, N2EO.
And I hope we have some computer mavens listening who are going to chime in. I'm going to tell you a little bit of my grief along these lines. The main client that I visit the majority of my days, who employs me, has loaned me for my daily use a True Blue machine? I'm not sure. Or is it a Dell? I think it's a Dell machine. And it was a 2001 vintage or 2002 vintage machine. And it's now, for the last 6 months, giving me an awful lot of grief. It hiccups every couple of days. I'm calling up the IT department quite frequently. And they're giving me various chunks of assistance, but they keep telling me that, hey, this is an ancient machine. You're wasting your time. It's always going to run slow. It has has various kinds of incompatibility with the latest versions of Microsoft and other and Adobe Acrobat and these other programs. The machine has a degree of incompatibility. So when I hear the word 10-year-old machine, whether it be a desktop or a laptop, I know that you're in some trouble when it comes to its incompatibility with modern stuff. The sad state of affairs is that our computers, let me drop. I mean, you could be treating the machine with tender, loving care. Always cleaning out its fan, make sure it's got plenty of cooling. You make sure you got the right kind of a surge suppressor. It's never been getting any spikes to its power supply. You're doing everything just right. And you would like to think that the electronics that's in there should work for 50 years. And here we are 8, 9, 10 years downrange, and everybody's telling us, you've got a dinosaur, it's ancient, and don't waste your time, and it's time you upgrade. I hear those words all the time. In one of the factories where I work, every 4 or 5 years, I will see a hall full of, let me pick a number, 150 displays and computers all being thrown out for scrap because they're 7 or 8 years old and they're all being upgraded. My goodness, are we wasteful along those lines. But that's another whole story. So that's one of the problems you're running into. The older hard drives had nowhere near the reliability of the modern ones. That's another thing you're working into. And so I'm also, as you can tell, rather light on computers. I claim to be an analog person, an RF person. My son is heavily into computers and Linux and networking systems and whatever. Just the vocabulary that gives in all of that floors me at times. A person has to know his limitations, and boy, am I limited when it comes to computers. So I hope somebody's on frequency. Because this is not the computer net, but still it's a darn valid question. Can anybody help Rich recover these 100 photographs on his 10-year-old laptop that appears to be having a crash of its hard drive? If anyone can give us some help, without telling him to go to an organization that's going to charge him $1,000 to recover the data off that hard drive, which he might not want to do. Other than that, if somebody's got a real suggestion, please give me your call letters right now. K2RIW and the TechNet.
WGP with a recommendation.
John recognized, and anyone else? Looks like you're it, John. I hope you got a good one. WGB, K2RIW.
Good evening, Dick. Mel. Yeah, Rich, you might want to try, I don't know if you have a systems disk, but if not, you have the disk to boot. If you could move over into the DOS area, you can move those files through your COM port. Just set up your COM port at, say, 9600 port, and move them. Use CON to, copy COM1 to copy the files, get your files, set them up, and copy to COM1, and then port your other computer into it and directly transfer the files into the other computer. It works very well and very quick, and if you can get it to come up to systems disk or get that to boot properly, you should be able to get into the DOS mode and go into directory and see the photos that you want to move and just pick and choose them as you go.
Over to you, Rich, if you got some requests. I wouldn't have understood that. You got it, Rich.
Okay, John, the problem is it's saying that there's data loss, and I don't see, I brought up the folder which where they are in, that was supposedly in my pictures, and I don't see anything coming up. And the other thing that were on the drive were coming up in my programs. They are no longer coming up. It's saying empty. So I don't know if it's really empty, if it's a canned message, or possibly the data is still somehow recoverable from the hard drive. Yeah, John.
Okay, Rich, I'm assuming you're running Windows. There's a mode, if you look in your files, that says MS-DOS. Can you get to that mode? If you can, you can call up a directory. Do you know how to do that in DOS? Just a DIR, and then ask, call up the drive letter. That'll give you, all of the directories will come up. Then you can rewrite your directory for that specific directory, and it will expose all of the files in there. And you should be able to see your MVC files for photographs or MPEGs, whatever you got in there. If you can get to that, you can transfer them.
Okay, John, good idea. I think is, yeah, I would have to, I'm not sure, how do I get to DOS? It's Windows XP. How would I get to DOS from a startup?
Go into DOS, go into where it says start, all programs is the next selection you want to get to. When you bring up all programs, or if you can get into the my computer panel, do it that way. Go through the start, all programs, you'll see it list, you'll see MS-DOS there. When you click on that, it'll put you in a DOS shell, and you should be able to transfer files from there without any problem at all. If you're familiar with DOS from the old days, which I think you are, you'll remember how to use the directories and move the directories.
Now, let me ask you this one, John. I've been in a situation like Rich is in right now, and maybe he's a lot more computer savvy than I am. A person can give me the words and say, oh, it's fairly simple, you just do this, this, and this. And somehow, because I have so little familiarity with those particular functions of a desktop machine, it doesn't really communicate. If the person is on the telephone with me, and he's instructing me on each one of the steps, what do you see on the screen? Tap on the so-and-so indication. Write in such and such, and if on each one of the steps the person is on the telephone with me telling me what to do, by a 10-to-1 ratio, I get a lot more response. So is it possible, John, that you and Rich could get on the twisted pair with each other and you could help him walk through these individual steps? I know we're asking you for something beyond the call of duty here, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, sure, Dick. I'd be glad to help Rich out any time. I don't know if you have my phone number, Rich, but you could do that. I'd be more than happy to help you out, or if you want to go to a repeater like 147 where we can do it on the air, whatever. But I'm a little rusty in DOS, but I did a lot of programming in DOS. Those are, talk about dark ages, Dick. Writing programs in DOS is not fun. A little better than machine language, but a little rough. But you're right, Dick. If you haven't done it, and you know, the problem with DOS is if you forget a decimal point or you forget a signature, nothing works, and it'll drive you nuts. So I'd be more than happy to help you if I can, Rich.
So you guys got to pass phone numbers. Rich, it's your turn.
Okay, thank you very much, John and Dick. Well, let me, John, my email address, send me an email, and it's ntuio@nyc.rr.com. ntuio@newyorkcityroadrunner.com, okay?
Rich, I'll give you the phone number over the air. I do that all the time. I have no problem with that.
Okay, I thought that. All right, so by way of the email addresses, n2eo@nyc.
Okay, I just jumped frequency. I wound up on 14691. I don't know, I must have hit something. Give me the phone number, John.
Okay, Rich. Area code 718-447-3426.
473426.
You got it.
718, right? What is Staten Island?
That's correct. 718-447-3426. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, let's hope that you can recover those photographs. And DOS is a darn good thing to know. I think DOS fell right after CPU or vice versa. We're getting down to the molecular level or the atomic level of the computer when you get down to CPU or DOS.
CPM,
that's what I should have said. You're right. When it comes to handheld Hewlett-Packard computers, everything there, the base level, the machine language, is in reverse Polish Lisp language. Ain't that something? That's how they were able to, in the case of the Hewlett-Packard 28S, man, that machine with a quarter megabyte of RAM could do functions that machines that had 10 megabytes couldn't do.
I'm sure you had experience with COBOL and Fortran in your time, too.
I used quite a bit of Fortran. I used quite a bit of HPL. Let's see now. Microsoft, what was the early Microsoft language called? All of a sudden I can't think of it.
Well, the conversion was MS-DOS, but it was just DOS before that.
Yeah, I did quite a bit of basic, super basic Fortran. And when it comes to the handheld Hewlett-Packard machines, did a lot of writing in Lisp and Forth. The nice thing about the Hewlett-Packard 28 is that each of those languages have certain commands that give you an advantage depending on what you're doing. And the nice thing about the 28S is that you could write one single line of code that uses all six languages. Algebraic, reverse Polish, basic, Fortran, Lisp, and Forth. You could use one line of code and flip back and forth between all of those languages in that code of that line, and the machine would figure out what in the world you want. You have to be a little bit careful in some of the syntaxing, but my goodness, did that help you when it comes to self. I could look at a program I wrote in that manner 5 years later, and I didn't even have to have an explanation section as to what it does, how it does it, just by looking at the first few lines of code when you've got that capability. And thank goodness HP on all their later machines, like the 50G, I think is the one I got now, the latest one. I'll take a look at the darn thing. 50G. It also has all of that capability. It speaks all of those languages. So to me, that's the way to go. So with all those languages, I've never learned really CPM or DOS. When it comes to laptops, I'm a real neophyte. When it comes to handhelds, I was using my handheld computers as a portable digital assistant in 1982, even before they had the PDA, so to speak. I was putting everybody's phone number and important programs and whatever in a handheld computer.
A question, Dick.
HP 15 and HP 28. Go ahead, John.
Let me see if I understand this right. You could write one line and your REM line.